sign is 9:01 a.m. Today is July 28th, 2021. Please be advised that an investment committee meeting of the Annuity and Pension Board has been scheduled for Wednesday, July 28th, 9 a.m. This meeting will be conducted via teleconference. If we can have a roll call, please.
Mr. Campbell?
Present.
Ms. Ford? Ms. Ford?
Present.
Ms. King?
Here.
Mr. Klusman?
Here.
Mr. Conrad?
Here.
Mr. Kovac?
Here.
Ms. Sawa?
Here.
Mr. Bell?
Here. First off, just like to thank everybody for accommodating the schedule change from Thursday to Wednesday. Much appreciated. And the agenda is as follows. Item number one, Callan Infrastructure Implementation Updates. And who do we have here from Callan?
John, are you there?
You're muted if you speak.
Okay.
I am John Jackson here and Mike Jakin as well. Sally Haskins and Veneer from our Real Assets Group will be presenting an update on the infrastructure implementation.
Thanks, John.
Great, thanks for...
Oh. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, good morning, everybody. I'm sorry, I've got sort of a weird backlit light today. I'm in a different location, but anyway, so Munir's here with me, and we've been working with your staff since really the infrastructure allocation was approved and even before that point. And so if you remember, it was a 2% allocation. And we decided after you all approved that we would do some education and look at the investment manager universe and where people, managers were with regard to buying assets and growing their funds and managing their funds, especially coming out and, well, not even coming out, but being in COVID, to see how things were doing and what the options were. For you all to potentially invest the allocation in infrastructure. So we did that over the course of the past, you know, really 2 months. And at the end of the day, decided that we'd like to put a pause on implementation and defer it until probably sometime next year. And the reason being is, again, to continue to track the universe as funds managed through COVID. And then also there are a handful of funds that are newer funds that are buying assets and growing their portfolios that we think will become true investable options sometime next year. And we don't think there's any harm in waiting and having more options to look at rather than fewer. So that's the recommendation that we put forth in our memo, and we're happy to answer any questions about that.
Thank you, Sally. Any questions from members or staff?
This is Rudy Conrad. It says, when did the infrastructure bill somehow play into your thinking, or will that somehow affect the number of projects available, or is it really irrelevant considerations?
I mean, it doesn't, it didn't totally factor into it, but certainly we'll have more clarity on that if we wait. I don't think it's going to hurt anything to wait and see what happens there. It may increase the number of projects that are available for investment or the public-private partnership type projects. So.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Klusman.
Go ahead, Mr. Klusman.
Yeah, just Sally, is there a, I noticed on the bullet points, the week of May 24th point and week of June 20th to 27th. what, is there a story there? What, that the, you did the three and then went back and did six more? Was the plan originally nine, or did you find something in the initial May 24th meetings where you went back out and found six more and then still want to pause? Am I reading too much into that, or?
No, yeah, it was just timing, just who, when we had time to do the meetings more than anything. So, you know, I think there was not a whole lot more other than, you know, the three that we interviewed initially are the ones that are more developed, right, and have a longer track record. You know, so we did those, and then we decided, yeah, you know, why don't we just survey the entire universe for just more education and to just to make sure that everybody knows the universe, right? So, so maybe a little bit of both, right?
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
If you don't mind, I'll just add that we had an investment committee meeting on June 10th also. So just to Sally's point on timing, I mean, we kind of did, we felt like we had a sample before the June 10th meeting. Then we, Sally and Munir gave the updates at June 10th. And then we tried to do as many as we could before this meeting as well. So.
Great, thank you. Any other comments or questions?
Yeah, this is Rudy Conrad again. Sorry, Sally. What I was thinking about is this controversy now over whether we have temporary inflation or permanent inflation. Right. And if you're investing in an infrastructure project that's being built or will be built, is that something that we need clarity on? Otherwise,
invest in the project
that winds up costing much more than anticipated.
I
think we might have more clarity next year.
I mean, maybe, right? But that's one of the questions we're asking the infrastructure managers broadly, is how they think their portfolios are going to do both in an inflationary and a rising interest rate environment. So that could come in, like you said, if you're building new projects and construction costs are more than you anticipated, right? Or in existing projects, depending on how the leases are written, they might just have flat, or the contracts, they might just be a flat amount, and then you could have flat revenue, but you could have maybe rising costs at your project, right? Or alternatively, if you have floating rate debt, and then you have to refinance in a higher interest rate environment. A long way of saying that, yes, there's a lot of stuff that's going on, and I think that sort of ties into the point about what is happening in the economy and what is happening as we come out of COVID, right? And what's the operating environment going to be? So thank you for raising that point.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Right, not hearing any. I appreciate the info, Sally. I don't think we need to make a motion for this because it's remaining the same. Is that correct, Jerry?
There's a motion, right, Jerry?
Yes,
sure.
Yes,
okay. You're correct.
I thought you said Terry.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, Matt, you're right.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you, Sally. We will move on to item number two. Real assets allocation memo, and is that going to be handled by Mr. Silber?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Hopefully the memo speaks for itself for the most part. The point of this memo is really to give the board comfort that we're thinking about, and we kind of have a plan in place. I mean, as you know, we increased our real assets allocation from 11% to 13%, and we set aside, kind of identified 2% to go into infrastructure. But as we just talked about, I mean, as the memo states, it's going to be at least a few years before we're talking about actually getting all the money invested. So the purpose of this memo is really to kind of talk about what our how to think about those extra 2% that won't be in infrastructure. I guess the good news and the main thing here is that our actual real assets allocation as of about a week ago is actually around 12.2%. So we're only talking about an underweight of less than 1% given how much we currently have in private real estate as well as in principal, which is our liquid diversified real assets investment. The memo goes into a brief detail about some of what makes it difficult about trying to precisely time a real assets allocation. I mean, not only is infrastructure going to be difficult to time precisely, but real estate, since it's relatively illiquid, will be as well. If we tried to get more money into it, it could take quarters to get the money in. If we wanted to get the money out, it could, in some cases, in time of stress, it can take more than a year to do that. So we're really basically saying let's live with the real assets allocation as is. It'll fluctuate naturally as stocks go up or down. I mean, if stocks go up a lot over the next few months, you might see the real assets allocation go down. If stocks went down a lot over the next couple months, you'll see that underweight actually disappear if real estate goes down less than stocks, which we would hope it would in that environment. And the last point we made is, if when we think about real assets, it's kind of in the middle of the risk return spectrum of where we invest. Our return drivers of the portfolio are private equity and public equity stocks. And those both happen to be overweight right now. While kind of the risk mitigator pieces of our portfolio, absolute return and fixed income, are both underweight right now. So we talk about in the memo how if we are posed or with a decision of how to think about this underweight to real assets, our bias is to think about offsetting it with an overweight to fixed income, especially as long as we're overweight some of these higher risk returning asset classes in the portfolio. But for practical purposes, our guidelines we have wide latitude, wide ranges in there around the targets. So we're within guidelines no matter how you look at it. So these are just things we're going to be talking about or thinking about when we're pulling money out to pay benefit payments or in the event we ever do hit a rebalancing trigger. I guess it would come into play. I'm happy to take any questions if there are any.
Any questions for David? All right, thanks David for the thanks David for the information. Next, items 3 and 4 require us to convene into closed session. Please be advised that the investment committee may vote to convene in closed session on the following items. Item 3 and 4, as provided in section 19.85 sub 1 sub e Wisconsin state statutes, to deliberate or negotiate the purchasing of public properties, the investing of public funds, or conducting other specified public business whenever competitive or bargaining reasons require a closed session. The investment committee may then vote to reconvene in open session following the closed session. I have a motion to go into closed session.
Conrad moves to go into closed session.
Thank you, Mr. Conrad. A second. Thank you, Mr. Campbell. It is now 9:14 a.m.
Do I need to do a roll call to go into closed session?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes, please.
Mr. Campbell?
Aye.
Ms. Ford?
Aye.
Ms. King?
Aye.
Mr. Klusman?
Aye.
Mr. Conrad?
Aye.
Mr. Kovac?
Aye.
Ms. Sawa?
Aye.
Mr. Bell?
Aye.
And could you say the time again, please?
9:15 a.m.
Okay, we are back in open session. Everybody's on.
All right, thank you. We're back in open session regarding item four, the approval of absolute return structure. We had a motion and a second regarding the adoption of mix two for the absolute return structure. Need a roll call vote regarding?
Mr. Campbell?
Aye.
Ms. Ford? Ms. Ford?
Aye.
Ms. King?
Aye.
Mr. Klassman?
Aye.
Mr. Conrad?
Aye.
Mr. Kovac?
Aye.
Ms. Sala?
Aye.
Mr. Bell?
Aye.
Motion passes.
With that, item four, approval of absolute return structure for the mix two presented today. Next item, remaining in open session will be item five, BlackRock due diligence report. I believe, Mr. Courtright, are you handling that today?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, presenting the BlackRock, Eric Stauer, Tony Leparski, and myself conducted a virtual due diligence meeting with BlackRock 3rd, 2021, and overall I'd say it was a very good meeting, and I'd like to provide some highlights from the memo that you have in your head. As you may know, BlackRock is the fund's large manager in terms of assets. This includes the three strategies we have with them: the global strategy, the Russell 1000 value strategy, and the U.S. aggregate bond index strategy. Those three together total $49 million, or approximately 15.8% of ERS assets. Generally speaking, a single manager exposure of such a level of 15.8% of assets might be considered to be somewhat concentrated. However, if two of the three strategies with BlackRock and the majority of the assets of BlackRock are passive strategies, that's the 1000 value index and the U.S. aggregate bond index, the risk is really mitigated significantly. I point out that scale really matters when you're doing a passive strategy that is either fully replicated like the Russell 1000 value, or stratified sampling, which is nearly fully replicated, like the U.S. aggregate bond index. Large AUM and resources and operational synergies really matter significantly when you have those kind of strategies. And BlackRock, one of the largest asset managers in the world, and it gives us great comfort that their ability is really world-class in those capabilities. Global Alpha Tilts is the third one. That's an active strategy mandate for global core equity. And we'll touch on that briefly as well. So I'd like to briefly point out four more highlights for the strategies. BlackRock has an experienced and stable investment team for each of the strategies, which is what we like to see, particularly for active managers such as the Global Alpha Tilts. Secondly, we saw that BlackRock continues to invest significantly and develop technology within the firm and also within the specific systematic active equity group, which is where our investment team for our Alpha Tilt strategy resides. And just as a quick kind of second subpoint to this, systematic active equity group, it manages Alpha Tilts. It's essentially investing along quantitative signals that have fundamental, macro, or sentiment insights in the markets. And they put a lot of money into developing and researching proprietary data. We have advanced satellite, mobile telecom, internet technology that they try to exploit to generate signals, and that's really the lifeblood of their strategy. And as a result, they have the systematic active equity team has hundreds of signals in their research library that they can select from and combine in implementing the portfolio. Systematic active equity is continually developing proprietary data and research and related signals and implementing the active positions within the portfolio. And I would say that staff and Callan, we spoke with Callan quite a bit during the due diligence. We came away impressed with Systematic Active Equity's resources, their scale, and their abilities in implementing their philosophy and their process. As a fourth point that I'd like to highlight, BlackRock continues to realize significant synergy on an operational basis and operational scale. And that's really associated with the BlackRock increases in assets under management at the firm level, as well as at the individual strategy level. As we mentioned previously, this allows advantages in overall scale, such things as trading costs, and even at the strategy level, improved breadth and depth of something like stratified sampling, where you're trying to fully replicate the index, as in our fixed income, the U.S. aggregate index. So in conclusion, you know, overall staff and Callan are very comfortable with the passive strategy management capability exhibited by BlackRock and also very impressed with the Systematic Active Equity Group, their ability to use technology and proprietary data to develop investment insights. And I'd emphasize too that or Systematic Active Equity, diversification and risk control are a very large part of their process and always have been. And those are key strengths of the strategy as well. These points give us comfort that BlackRock is very capable to fulfill the mandates that we have with them. So that completes my prepared remarks. If there are any comments, I'd be happy to take them.
Thank you, Tom. Any comments or questions? All right, not hearing any, move on to item number 6, second quarter 2021 preliminary performance report. Mr. Sauer, are you handling that?
I am, thank you, Mr. Chair. Terry, I'll start out on page 3 of the report. So we can see on here that it was a very strong quarter for stocks with the AQI MI up 7.2%. Bonds performed well as interest rates fell and real assets did well also. But you can see on here that private equity is the really big story. So this is the way that this works every year, but you'll remember in the first quarter we talked about not having any private equity reports come in, so the return was really just slightly negative, which reflects just some fee drag. And then in the fourth quarter, in this quarter we had fourth quarter private equity reports come in, as well as first quarter 2021 reports come in. So that 33.5% that we're showing is really two quarters of data. It's a very strong return for two quarters, but you know, just keep in mind that it is two quarters. So the combination of all that meant that the fund was up 7.4% for the quarter. We'll go to slide 4 now, Terry. So this is where we look at our benchmark relative performance. So you can see that both small cap and value went against us this quarter, and it's interesting because there were reversals month to month. So I think you've seen a lot of the stock market just trying to sort out, you know, inflation and reopening and you know, virus variants, and that can change again whether value or growth is leading the way on a month to month basis. So you can see that the, you know, while value and small cap were drags, you know, certainly not as significant as some of what we saw in 2020, where, you know, growth just consistently led the way. But then we also had fixed income credit with Luma sales, which was a benefit. And then, again, the comparing the, those two quarters of private equity returns, you know, to the quarterly PE benchmark, that, that puts a big benefit into this quarter. So return came out to 7.4 versus 4.8 for the benchmark. We'll move on to slide six now. And you can actually see some nice outperformance on this slide. So in addition to the quarterly return, strong year-to-date outperformance, 1 year, 5 year numbers, matching over the 7 and 10, that you can see that brings the 10-year rolling excess return line back up to even with the benchmark. So that's nice to see. Could go ahead to slide seven. Private equity here we'll hold off on for a second. We'll talk about that on the next slide. But you can see other than private equity, it wasn't a super eventful quarter. We had outperformance among growth managers, Blair and Poland, you know, which we hope, something that's something we hope to see in a growth market. And that was roughly offset by the style bias, which we mentioned before, value and small cap underperformed. We can move forward to slide eight now. So with the two quarters of return, of private equity return going into private equity, it's much better to look at things on a year-to-year basis. So now on this page, we're really comparing apples to apples with that 33.4 private equity return, which, you know, as I said, incorporates the slight fee drag we had in the first quarter. So that compares to a benchmark return of 23%. So that generated, you know, some nice outperformance against the benchmark, and private equity added, you know, 90 basis points to our relative returns. You know, and I'll just note that the private equity benchmark that we use already builds in a 200 basis point premium over public markets. You know, so I think realistically we could, if we were in a scenario where private equity matched that benchmark and you know, we were sitting here and saying it had zero impact on benchmark relative returns, it would still be hitting its goals of generating a premium above public markets. So the fact that it's outperforming that premium that we're hoping for it to generate, you know, just speaks to really how strong the those two quarters of returns were. You know, looking at the rest of the portfolio, so, you know, small in value went against us in the second quarter, but not enough to completely reverse the outperformance, you know, that we've seen year to date from small in value. So when you're looking at a year to date basis, see things like Brandis and the DFA strategies adding 90 basis points to returns collectively. The U.S. small and value style bias still adding, you know, approximately 30 basis points. Fixed income, you know, adding 30 basis points of manager selection, which is primarily the sale. And then, you know, real assets also adding, you know, 30 basis points, which is primarily from core real estate outperformance. We'll go to slide 12 now. So I've updated this slide with the actual percentile ranks from Northern Trust. What you have in your packet when that went out, you know, Northern Trust didn't have, you know, in particular our UBS return in. So we kind of knew roughly where we would fall. We knew the quartiles, but we weren't sure of the exact percentiles. Now we have those. So I put those up. But you can see in you know, second quarter, still a very strong quarter, you know, which is not something we expect to see when small and value go against us. And I think that, again, just really speaks to, you know, the really strong private equity numbers that we've reflected. So, you know, well into that top quartile against our peers, you know, in the second quartile year to date and 1 year, you know, and then looking out longer term, we're above median in the 5, 7, and 10 years, you know, compared to our peer funds, which is nice to see. We'll go to slide 14 now. And, you know, I know we don't normally spend a lot of time on this slide, but I'll just pause on it to note that this is the first time we've put a $6 billion fund value in that column at the right. You know, and then you just see some of the other numbers on this page, the amount of benefits that have been paid out, you know, over the time that we're showing here, really since just before the financial crisis. And it just really, you know, speaks to, you know, what this fund does. It's just really pretty amazing. We'll go to slide 17 now. So these are our notable manager events. So Reams announced at the end of June that their president, Dave McKinney, retired. You know, this is something that they said has actually been in the works for a while now, and he actually agreed to stay on, you know, through COVID to just avoid any disruption. But now that, you know, it seems like we're certainly coming out of the other end, or, you know, hopefully the worst of it's over. You know, he felt the time was right to retire. Dan Spurgeon, the vice president of operations, is going to be promoted to president. He's been with Reams for 17 years. As I mentioned, there's been a long transition with the fact that this has been planned for quite a while. So this is not expected to have any changes to our strategy. And we expect that the impact to the firm will be minimal and it should be a smooth transition. So really no major concerns there. And then Newton, really just the day before this presentation went out, they announced that Kurt Custard would be stepping down from his CIO role to take a reduced role, you know, due to some family situations or what they noted. So they're going to recruit a new CIO to replace him, and we'll work with Cal and to understand the implications of what that means for Newton going forward. We'll move to slide 19 now. So in here you can see some underperformance in the quarter for our public equities, which again, in the style bias going against us, so that's not totally unexpected. But nice outperformance in the year to date over the past 1 year as the small and value biases really worked in our favor. Also exceeding over the 5 and 10 year time periods and matching in the 10 year, which, you know, that's really pretty amazing when you reflect on the stark growth value disparity that we went through that culminated in 2020. It just speaks to, you know, how quickly when value comes back and starts working, these things can reverse. So just, you know, speaks to, you know, both David and the board really staying the course, you know, with respect to that public equity allocation. You know, it's worked out well for the fund. We can move to slide 20 now. And again, similar comments along similar lines. You know, so for the second quarter, you know, with the small and value biases going against us, you wouldn't expect us to rank super high in the universe, and you can see that's the case, just below median. But you know, solidly top quartile over the year to date and 1 year period, and then right around median 5, 7, and 10 years. So again, pretty good results versus our peers. Go to slide 23 now. And again, on here, this is really just the best kind of factual representation of the value bias, or statistical representation, if you will. So you can see, you know, our price to earnings ratio, price to book ratio, price to cash flow ratio, all lower than the benchmark. So that's really what you would expect to see with when you're going for a value bias and just, you know, proof that things are being implemented, you know, the way we're intending. We'll go to slide 25 now. So this slide looks, you know, a little different than we're used to seeing, and that's why I mentioned earlier that there were reversals in growth and value leadership throughout the quarter. So that's how you get the slide looking the way that it does. You know, typically we either see it's a growth quarter and there's growth managers on here, there's, you know, vice versa with value. But in this case, you know, you see, you know, Poland, Blair, Castle Arc, MFS, which again you expect in a growth quarter. But we're also seeing Brandis, DFA, you know, AQR, which is a core manager, but valuation plays a significant role in their process. You know, just with those reversals during the quarter, they, you know, the value managers, you know, outperformed when their style was in favor, and it was enough to generate outperformance over the full quarter. Again, so just nice to see. And then, you know, I'll point out just some very strong, you know, one-year numbers out of Castle Arc, Brandis, DFA, U.S. small value, and then the strong longer-term numbers from Poland, Blair, Castle Arc, MFS. You know, just it's nice to see those managers, you know, outperforming when we would expect them to. Move ahead to slide 26 now. You know, Earnest, I'll just note, their performance has really been so good recently that we haven't had to talk about this, but, you know, just to remind some of the board members that have been here longer, and for some of the newer board members, this may be the first time we're talking about it, but Earnest really does have a big focus on downside protection in their investment process. You know, so when you see a market that's up, you know, in the 1 year, you know, we're showing Earnest up, you know, 45.8, underperforming by 4%. So that means that, you know, the benchmark was up nearly 50%. That's kind of what we expect from Earnest, that they're going to trail just a little bit in those huge up markets like that. And that just comes down to the focus on downside protection that they have. But really, you know, the thing to keep in mind with Earnest is just that the longer-term numbers have been very good. You know, 14.3% returns, you know, annualized over 10 years with 1% outperformance. So that means, you know, not only have mid-caps been a good place to invest in the stock market, but that Earnest has done a good job of investing there. So, you know, just nice to see out of them. And then, you know, Alpha Tilts, I mean, Tom just talked about Alpha Tilts earlier, but as a quant manager, you know, quants can struggle around reversals at times. So to see them, you know, really not being far off the benchmark in the shorter term time periods, you know, I think that speaks to the risk controls that they have in place. And then, you know, DFA, U.S. large value, you know, they just only slightly underperforming in the quarter. You know, we're rounding actually up to zero. You know, but nice outperformance from them out in the 1 year period, you know, which is again what we're looking for our value managers to do in a value market. You know, I will go up to slide 31 now. So within fixed income, you know, you can see Luma Sales is the real standout here over the past 1 year, outperforming by 11%. You know, and then good longer-term numbers out of both Loomis and Reams. Remember, we had that really, really strong year last year, which you see reflected in their longer-term numbers. I'll go to slide 36, Terry, which is, that's the first private equity slide. The number got cut off. But so we've talked quite a bit about PE already, so I'll try to be quick, but, you know, the strong returns that came in, mean that a lot of funds on this page have moved close to or above a 2 TVPI total value to paid-in capital, which that's really a mark of great success for a private equity fund-to-fund. And then the other thing I'll point out is if you look at the chart in the bottom left, which has the blue and red bars, blue bars represent capital calls, and the red represents distributions. So you can see that in recent quarters, those red distribution bars are, you know, matching or a lot of times exceeding the capital call bars. So that means that our private equity program has really reached a point where it's self-funding and it's generating excess cash for the fund, you know, which is nice to see in addition to those, you know, valuation markups that we get from the private equity, which you know, goes into fund returns. You know, it just makes things a little easier that it's also generating cash as well, and we're seeing some of those returns actually come back in tangible dollars. And then I'll finish up on slide 39, just with a quick performance update. And this I've gone ahead and updated with, you know, values as of yesterday. So the fund had an estimated value of $6.04 billion. You know, year to date through June, we had the fund up 11.2 versus 8.0 for the benchmark. So far in July, you know, fund is up 0.4 in July, which is matching the benchmark. And that brings the year to date return to 11.7 versus 8.4 for the benchmark. And again, that's obviously net of fee returns for the fund. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to take them. Otherwise, that concludes the quarterly performance update.
Thank you, Eric. Any questions or comments? All right, not hearing any. That wraps up all the items for today. I'd like to wish everyone a nice break for August, and we will talk and hopefully see each other in September.
Mr. Chair, this is Mr. Campbell. I'd like to make a motion to adjourn.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Campbell, a second.
Ms. King, a second.
Thanks, Mr. King. Everybody have a good day.
You want to just say the time, please?
I think so. Oh, yeah. Time is 11:29 a.m.
Thank you.